everyone, and welcome to another edition of Criminal Discourse Podcast. I'm Trish.
And I'm Wendy.
Back with you with an all new episode. But before we jump into that new episode, I do have some crime news updates.
Is it Sophie?
It is. Now, we pre-record these episodes. So this information occurred in January, even though this episode isn't airing till February. But Ian Bailey died on the 27th of January. He had collapsed on a street in Bantry, Ireland that Sunday. Members of the public attempted to render aid by performing CPR before the paramedics arrived, but he was later pronounced dead of a cardiac arrest. Now, he had, I think, two or three heart attacks. He was looking possibly at a surgery in spring if he got a little stronger, but unfortunately, he passed away. His remains have been cremated and his remains sent to his sister, who resides in England. Now, Sophie's family, in an article in the Journal, reaffirmed their belief that Ian Bailey was responsible for Sophie's murder. The cold case review by the Gardaí still continues, and Sophie's family is encouraging anyone who may have important information to come forward if they were concerned about doing so while Bailey was alive. Now, in an article in the Irish Mirror on the 22nd of January, this was 5 days before Bailey died, this article talked about Dr. Happerson's medical examination of Sophie. She suffered more than 60 individual injuries when she was beaten to death. They included everything from a broken jaw and a fractured skull to the bruising on her back and a broken hand. Small blood traces were found on parts of Sophie's clothing. Blood that fell on her may be what's currently being tested. He says she was beaten to death with two blunt instruments. I believe it was the concrete block, or what they call a breeze block, and a slate rock, and died from brain injuries and a fractured skull. The professor's report shows Sophie had 12 separate wounds to her head, including a 1 3/4 inch laceration on her forehead and a 1.5 inch cut over her right ear, other similar cuts above her right eyebrow, and 10 separate lacerations to her scalp, including one that was 3 inches long and hemorrhages beneath her lower left eyelid. Reports say that she also had extensive bruising on her stomach, bruising and scratches on her back, buttocks, and part of her upper lip was torn away from the gum. Two finger bones were broken on her left hand, and both hands were bruised and scratched. Her right arm also has bruises, and there were scratches on her right leg, calf, and knee. Needless to say, all of those injuries, she put up a hell of a fight.
A horrific way to pass. I think when you get to a case that's so infamous, so well known, you're getting into the weeds of so many details of alibis and different suspects, you forget about exactly what she went through in those moments.
She did.
That really makes you remember.
She did. And the reason I share that is I never came across all of that at the time I was researching the case. Like, he was very tight-lipped as to, there were little things that come out. Her family said she was somewhat unrecognizable when they first saw her body, but I didn't know the extent of what she went through and the fight that she put up, the defensive wounds that she had. So the investigation continues. My understanding is they're going to see it out, even though one suspect is now deceased.
Should get interesting, if anything. Now, before we get into today's case, we just want to take a moment to say that we know there are so many true crime podcasts out there to choose from, and only so many hours in a day. And we want to take a moment to say how much we truly appreciate you choosing to listen to our podcast today. If you want to join the discourse, you can reach out to us on our website. That's criminaldiscoursepodcast.com, or on social media. We're also on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube at Criminal Disc Pod and Criminal Discourse Podcast. And one last thing before we get started, the views and opinions discussed on our podcast are just our views and opinions. Everyone is presumed innocent until convicted in a court of law.
All right. Well, this case, interestingly enough, was really in part due to your research on the Corey Etkin case, more specifically with Merrill.
Oh, Merle Miller, Merle Rovinolt, Merle Plotz. She, quite a woman. We're still digging into her background and talking to people about her.
Right. So this is another individual. In this episode, we're going to look into the twisted tale of a woman who got away with her first murder, almost got away with her second, and failed to complete her third. This woman from the outside looked like an unlucky mother of two, whose two husbands died far too young and whose daughter tried to commit suicide. Betrayal, deception, and ultimately murder were the hallmarks of the Black Widow's calling card. So on Monday, August 22nd, 2005, Stacy Castor called 911, telling the dispatcher that her husband David didn't show up for work that morning and she didn't know what was going on. Now, when asked by the dispatcher if her husband had ever talked about hurting himself or harming himself, Stacy said, well, they had argued Friday night and he told her to take the kids and get out. But then he told her if she left, he would make her sorry. So she wasn't quite sure what was going on. Officer Robert Willoughby of the Onondaga County Sheriff's Office arrived at the Castor's Liverpool, New York residence. He banged on the couple's bedroom door after finding it was locked. Now, getting no answer, he kicked open the door and observed David Castor lying on his stomach across the bed. Now, he was naked and unmoving. Stacy called out from the hallway asking if David was okay, and Officer Willoughby replied, no, he's not. David Castor was dead at the age of 48. Now, paramedics who had arrived had gone into the room, but soon packed up their equipment and left. Stacy started screaming at them to say, go back in, he's not dead. She was beside herself, struggling emotionally on the front lawn when Detective Dominic Spinelli arrived. Stacy told the detective that she was worried that David might have committed suicide. She told him that there was a shotgun in the bedroom, and she claimed that David had been depressed lately due to the passing of his father. When Detective Spinelli entered the bedroom, he noticed on one of the nightstands there was a short glass filled half full with a green substance. Another glass held the remnants of what looked like juice. There was also an apricot brandy bottle and a diet cranberry juice bottle on the nightstand. The most interesting find that could explain what the green substance was in the glass was an empty bottle of antifreeze lying under the bed. It was found on its side with its cap off. Now, everything in the bedroom had been photographed, and you can see a photograph of this nightstand. I do have in our resource section of our notes are a lot of links, and a lot of those links have pictures of that nightstand. And everything was sent off for processing at the crime lab. Now, if the antifreeze bottle stood out to the police, it was what was found next by Officer Willoughby in the kitchen that really kind of took this investigation into a different direction. Willoughby had been talking to another officer when he noticed a turkey baster lying on top of the trash in the kitchen trash can. So he carefully picked it up and he noticed several green droplets on the inside of it. Next, he had pulled off the rubber ball end of the baster and smelt it, and it smelled of alcohol. Now, David Castor had met Stacy Wallace in 2001. He was divorced from his first wife, Janice Passant. David and Janice had one child, David Jr. He was an adult by now, and David Castor owned and operated his own heating and air conditioning business. Now, this was a second chance at love for both Stacy and David. Stacy had lost her first husband, Michael Wallace, in 2000. And on August 16, 2003, David and Stacy married. By this time, Stacy was actually working as David's office manager for his business. And their marriage seemed to be going well. They enjoyed all of the toys David had collected, such as motorcycles and ATVs and a boat. The only sticking point was the tense relationship between David and Stacy's two girls. At this time, Ashley was about 15 and Bree was 12. David told Ashley when he first got together with her mother and then they got married that he didn't want to be their father. He had already raised his child. However, the kids and David butted heads several times when he would want to insert himself like he was their father.
So he still wanted to have authority and run the household.
Correct. Now David was dead. Did David kill himself? Had he been so depressed over the death of his father that he ended his life in one of the most painful ways? David Castor died from ingesting ethylene glycol, the poisonous compound found in antifreeze. So Detective Spinelli wasn't convinced it was suicide, even though I think initially that's what it was ruled. Ethylene glycol is a painful way to die, like I said. According to the National Capital Poison Center, antifreeze brands taste bitter, right? So if you're making antifreeze, they purposely put a substance in there to make it taste bitter because ethylene glycol is very sweet. So it's often masked by mixing it with juices, alcohol, or soft drinks. So for several hours after someone ingests antifreeze, they may feel fine. But then the body is busy breaking down the ethylene glycol into several substances that affects the nervous system, the kidneys, and the blood chemistry. After more hours pass, the individual may feel groggy, like almost like they're drunk, right? Like they really ingested a lot of alcohol, and they experience some severe stomach distress. As more time passes without help, a person may slip into a coma. Organ damage can occur within 24 to 72 hours, and during that time, the kidneys may even stop working, so you're not urinating anything out of your system.
They just can't process anymore.
Right. And it only takes about 1 to 2 shot glasses of antifreeze to kill a grown man. Then there's the fact that it's very rare for someone to commit suicide naked. So Detective Spinelli's like, okay, this is really the way he chose to go, even though he had a shotgun in the bedroom, which they found. And there was no note left. So there was no suicide note that they could find. Lab technicians did find fingerprints on the underside of one of the glasses left on the nightstand. I believe it was the one that held the green antifreeze substance. 3 fingerprints in the area of someone holding it from the bottom, like if they were tipping it up to someone's mouth, like they were helping them drink it. Or it could be in the same area if somebody was taking a glass out of the dishwasher because it was upside down. But that's where they found the fingerprints. And those fingerprints belonged to Stacy Castor. Now, what stood out to detectives was the type of drinks also found on the nightstand. Apricot brandy and diet cranberry juice, they're more in line of what a woman may choose to drink than a man. Then there was what Stacy told detectives that led to David locking himself into the bedroom, like she claimed when she called 911. Stacy claimed that the couple had gotten into an argument over David wanting to go on an extended vacation to celebrate their anniversary. David would always close down his business for up to about 2 weeks in August, but this time he just wanted them to go away. He didn't want the girls to go with them. And Stacy did not want to be gone that long, as Bree at this time was only about 14 years old. And this led to their argument, with David becoming so upset that he grabbed a bottle of Southern Comfort and locked himself into the bedroom and didn't come out all weekend. That's what Stacy told the police. Now, at first, Stacy tells detectives she does feel David committed suicide due to the depression over losing his father, and says that, again, he locked himself into the bedroom after their argument. But there was no Southern Comfort bottle found on the nightstand, only that apricot brandy. Again, if he had a shotgun to use, why the antifreeze? And where does the turkey baster come into all this? So these are all the kind of questions the detectives, investigators are looking at. And then that there's no fingerprints found on the turkey baster, but David's DNA is found on the tip, meaning that turkey baster was put up to his mouth.
See, and if he's drinking the antifreeze himself, he's just going to drink it. He's just going to put it in the glass.
Right. You wouldn't need a turkey baster. So when in questioning David's ex-wife, Janice Besant Farmer, by then I think she got remarried, she told the detective that David, no, he would have never taken his own life. And although David and his son, David Jr., weren't as close as they once were, they were all shocked that David was left completely out of the will and only Stacy and her 2 daughters were mentioned. They got everything.
Okay, now it's starting to sound like Merle.
There you go. Janice stated that she didn't feel David would have not left anything for David Jr., and something wasn't right here. So David Jr. would initially challenge the will, but ended up withdrawing his challenge upon finding out that Lynn and Paul Pulaski had gone to the surrogate's court and signed an affidavit verifying that they, yes, had witnessed David Castor sign the most recent will. And I believe this will was signed in 2003, so 2 years prior to his death. So put a pin in that, because we're going to come back to it. So Detective Spinelli wanted to talk to Stacy's first husband, but found out he was about 5 years too late. Michael Wallace passed away on January 11th, 2000, from a heart attack. Or was it? Michael Wallace was 38 years old when he died after a short illness that started around Christmas of 1999. Stacy and Michael Wallace had met when she was 17 years old. I believe he was slightly older. And when she met him, she said it was love at first sight. She and Michael dated for 3 years before marrying on April 7th, 1990, in a small ceremony in her parents' home. Now, Michael worked second shift as a mechanic and Stacy at an ambulance dispatch center. I believe she worked a first shift. So the young couple had their first daughter, Ashley, in 1988, followed by Bree in 1991. And according to Stacy, Michael doted on his youngest daughter, calling her his princess. And not wanting Ashley to feel left out, she says she really cultivated their relationship not only as a mother and daughter one, but also becoming best friends. With young kids and working different shifts, the family had very little time to spend together, and this started to put a strain on the Wallace marriage. And then there was also the issue, according to Stacy, of Michael's drinking and possible drug use. Stacy confided into a friend around Thanksgiving 1999 that she was thinking about getting a divorce. And her friend gave her the name of a divorce attorney, but Stacy, she didn't think it was a good time with the holidays coming up and Michael having this mystery illness. Michael had been spending a lot of time in bed, having difficulty talking. He reported feeling very groggy, feeling almost drunk-like, and members of his family encouraged him to see a doctor. Now, I wasn't quite sure if he ended up seeing a doctor and they were still kind of confused as to why he was feeling this way, or he was planning to do so after the holidays, but on January 11th, 2000, Ashley, who was 11 years old at this time, she had come home from school and she saw her dad lying on the couch. I don't think that was out of the ordinary around this time. He slept a lot. And she would tell others that her dad, well, he had made funny faces that day. And at one point he put his one arm straight into the air and then it fell back down to his side. So she thought he had gone back to sleep. So she left the house to go pick up her younger sister from school and walk her home. I think this is something she always did. She got home first and then she left to go pick up her younger sister. Later that day, Michael was rushed to the local hospital. Physicians tried to revive him, but were unable to do so. Now, doctors told Stacy that Michael appeared to have died from a heart attack. And family members, well, they wanted an autopsy to answer the question of how a relatively healthy 38-year-old man with no history of heart problems dies from one over a couple weeks period. However, Stacy declined the autopsy, saying what the doctors told her was good enough for her. Stacy collected $55,034.72 from Michael's life insurance policy, which she paid for Michael's funeral expenses with, including burial plots for both of them, side by side, including a double-sided headstone. She then took the girls to Disney World to kind of help them adjust to life without their father and their new circumstances of it just being the three of them. That was, of course, until she met David Castor. Detective Spinelli, he wanted to know more about Michael's passing. It just didn't seem right with now one husband who's committed suicide, so he got a hold of Michael's medical records. Now, after looking at them, Detective Spinelli felt that there was another reason for Michael's death, and he went to work getting a court order to exhume his body. Now, at the gravesite that Detective Spinelli visited, he was in for another little surprise because right beside Michael Wallace's gravesite, there's a space for Stacy, of course, for when she passes on. Well, right on the other side of Stacy was David Castor's grave. Let that sink in a minute.
Wow. I'm also wondering, too, if the family had ever pushed for that, or I assume when Detective Spinelli came, I'm assuming he asked permission and they were into it.
It seemed, yeah, that they wanted answers.
Yeah.
They just didn't sit right with them that he had died the way he died. And if you watch an episode, I think it was a 2020 episode, I have it linked in the show notes. Nancy Grace is on it being interviewed. And she points out, like, she goes, well, there's Michael, there's David, Stacy, they can share her in the afterlife because of where she has positioned herself. So finally, after 2 years of investigation, gathering enough evidence, Michael's body was exhumed in September 2007. Now, David Castor died in 2005, so this had been a two-year investigation. The detectives, they just did not let this go. They just did not feel this was right. So the results for Michael's autopsy came in on September 5th. Michael's body was found to be full of tiny crystals, the telltale sign of ethylene glycol poisoning. And then on September 7th, Stacy Castor was brought in for a second interview with Detective Spinelli and Detective Valerie Brogan. Detective Spinelli started by asking Stacy, okay, so there were two glasses on the nightstand, and you say you poured him cranberry juice at one point, right? Yes, Stacy replied. Detective Spinelli asks, I'm going to show you a picture of two glasses. You remember which glass it was you poured the cranberry juice in? And Stacy looked at the picture and said, well, when I poured the antifreeze, she suddenly stopped. She corrected herself and she said, cranberry juice. And Detective Spinelli pressed, but you said antifreeze. Stacy immediately stopped the interview, insisting detectives were trying to frame her, trick her. She wanted an attorney. So Detective Spinelli, he took the photograph back from her. He opens the folder to put it back inside. And one of the top pictures in the folder is that of the turkey baster that was taken of it lying in the trash can. She questions the detective as to why he has that photo. And the detective replies, don't worry about it. The interview's over. So the investigators, they're now convinced that she had a hand in David Castor's demise. And so they're working on getting an arrest warrant, but they're also looking to wiretap her phones. They want to see, now that she's been shaken, what she's going to do. So those taps caught Stacy telling friends and anyone who would listen that she was scared because she didn't kill David. Stacy started to get worried when she found out Michael's body had been exhumed and being told that antifreeze was found in his remains. She was caught on a recording telling someone, quote, "I don't believe for one second they found antifreeze in Michael's body." Detectives then decided to visit Ashley at her school on the first day of college classes. This is September 12th, so this is moving rather quickly. Remember, we got the results back September 5th. They questioned Stacy September 7th. They decide to go visit Ashley at her college, and they inform her that her father did not die of a heart attack, but he had been poisoned with antifreeze. Now, Ashley became upset being told this information, especially on her first day of college classes. I can't imagine that. And she turns to the one person that she had been able to count on her whole life, her mother. She called Stacy, telling her what the detectives had told her. And this was all caught on some wiretaps. And Stacy then suggested, why don't you come over to the house? It's been a rough week. We'll have some drinks. So this is all occurring, like I said, on September 12th. Now, in later interviews, Ashley would say that her mother had never invited her to drink before. But being a teenage girl and being given permission by your parent to drink, she's like, I'm not going to turn that down. And it was a rough week being told this information. So when she arrived, Stacy had mixed up a 12-ounce drink in a plastic cup for her. And Ashley drank it down, she says, and then soon started to feel lethargic. So she went to her bedroom and soon passed out. So I think Ashley went to a local college and lived at home. So the next morning, she says she woke up. She was a bit hungover, but she got up and headed off to classes. So Stacy calls Ashley again the next day. This is now September 13th, inviting her to get back together again and drink. But this time that they would be drinking the hard stuff, she says. And the reason for this is that Stacy told Ashley that she probably wouldn't be around for her 21st birthday, so she wanted to celebrate it with her now. So Ashley pointed out to her mom during this phone call, like, it's not even noon yet, Mom. And Stacy told her, oh, well, it'll be noon by the time we're drinking. So once again, she goes home after classes. Stacy mixes up Ashley's drink and she hands it to her. Ashley took a drink and immediately was like, oh, that's nasty. Like, it's just nasty stuff. So Stacy got up and got her a straw, directed her to put the straw to the back of her throat and just drink it down. And she did. Now, the next morning, September 14th, Bree goes into Ashley's room only to find her making incoherent sounds and looking distressed. Ashley's eyes are open, but they're not looking at anything. They have that kind of far-off stare. Bree, upset, not knowing what's going on, immediately wakes up Stacy, her mom, and begs her to call 911. So for the second time in less than 2 years, Stacy Castor calls 911. She tells the 911 dispatcher that her daughter has taken some pills and was not breathing normally. Stacy then told the dispatcher that Ashley had drank an entire bottle of vodka. Again, she told the 911 dispatcher that Ashley had consumed this alcohol with a mixture of prescription drugs. Now, while on the phone with 911, Bree spots a piece of paper in Ashley's room. She reads it and then hands it to her mother. Stacy tells the 911 dispatcher that Ashley left a note. Quote, oh my God, this is not happening, she screams. Ashley is rushed to the hospital and it is catatonic upon arrival. Her heart rate is fluctuating between 170 and 190 beats per minute. And according to Dr. Daniel Olson with the SUNY Upstate Medical University Hospital, her vitals were plummeting and doctors were very concerned that she was not going to make it. Dr. Olson would later tell detectives that had Ashley not been found when she was and gotten the help she needed, she would have died at home. She was within 15 minutes of death when she arrived at the hospital. So when Ashley finally regained consciousness and was stable enough, detectives wanted to talk to her. And they asked her, what's the last thing you remember? And Ashley kind of explains to them that she went over, she had the drink, and then doesn't really remember anything else. They then ask her about the suicide note in which she took responsibility for killing her father and David Castor. Ashley is shocked. She's like, what are you talking about? She had no idea what they were telling her. Ashley tells them she didn't try to kill herself, nor did she leave a suicide note, and she had nothing to do with her father or David's death. Now, when Detective Spinelli had read over the 750-word typewritten note, even the signature is typed, there were a few things that jumped out at him. One was the word antifreeze. It was misspelled in several places and written out anti-free. A-N-T-I-F-R-E-E, all one word, the same way Stacy Castor pronounced it in her interview. So I am going to read you the 750-word suicide note. Now, it is all one long paragraph. There is no punctuation. There is no capitalization. It is full of spelling errors. Spell check was not used. I'm going to read this to you because I find it interesting.
Is it also chilling? Because I'm getting chills thinking about how this whole thing is playing out.
I think so, yes. Mommy, when you read the letter, just remember I love you, and everything I did is because I love you. I'm sorry all this is happening to you, but now everyone is going to know what really happened, and they know it wasn't you, it was me. None was ever supposed to know about Daddy. I told you when Daddy died, it was all my fault, and it was Daddy was doing things you never knew about. He was drinking, and when he was at the pick and pull house and at Lisa's house, he was smoking pot again too. I saw him. He was mean to you and me, and he only ever loved Bree. I couldn't let him do those things to you anymore. You think I remember how things were, but I do, and didn't want to ever live like that anymore. It wasn't fair to you or me. Daddy wasn't going to be good to you or be ever only Bree. I couldn't stand it anymore. The cops said there was antifreeze in Daddy's body, but did they tell anyone about the rat poison too? When I got home from school that day, I knew what was going on. Daddy was barely breathing. I knew he was going to die. That's why I didn't call you for help or anyone else. I wanted to make sure he couldn't be mean to you or me anymore. He died before I went to pick Bree up from school. I watched him, and I knew he couldn't hurt you anymore. Then we were happy for a while, just the three of us. And then you married David, and he was mean to you, too. He was mean to all of us, meaner than Daddy. And I knew you loved him like you loved Daddy, and you were going to let him treat you like he did, and you wouldn't leave. It wasn't fair, Mommy. He didn't love you or me or Bree. I never thought anyone would miss David, none. But you loved him, and it was harder than with Daddy because you were always home or with him. But it did it. I made sure he would never hurt you anymore to that Friday when David came home so you could go to the post office is when I first did it. It was easy. I asked him if he wanted something to drink, and I put antifreeze in his glass with some soda. He drank two whole glasses. That was it. Only it took longer for David than with Daddy. Once I put the antifreeze in Daddy's Gatorade, it only took a day or so. That's when he died, when you were sleeping on the couch after David locked himself in the room. I got the extra key because I knew where he hid it, and I put stuff in the room, and I tried to get him to drink some of the booze with the dropper thing, but he was gout of it, and wouldn't I pour the antifreeze in the glass and on the floor and left the bottle in the room, and then I put the gloves back in the kitchen and got ready for walk. You never knew, and know all of these cops are saying all this stuff about you to everyone you know and love, Mommy. It's just not fair. When you told me they dug up Daddy, they dug Daddy up. I knew that was going to happen. None was supposed to know, Mommy. And now they do, and they think you did it, but you didn't. It was me when the cops came to my school today. I thought they had figured it out. I was going to jail, but they didn't take me, Mommy. I can't live like this and watch what they are going to do to you. Not anymore, but can't go to jail for the rest of my life. I can't put you through that I did, and the only thing I could to help you, Mommy. I know you hate me for doing what I did, but Mommy, remember I love you more than anything, and I did it for you and for us. Please forgive me, Mommy. Someday when all this is over, please forgive me. Make sure you take care of Bree. She is all you have left now. Remember how happy we were together. You will be happy again, I promise you, Mommy. Tell Matt I love him. And I'm sorry. Tell Bree to be a good girl for you. And I love you now. Please don't hate me. Remember, I love you. Ashley.
This is so unbelievably deranged. Typos and all the grammar aside, this is so deranged because she wrote... Clearly Stacy wrote this. But writing it to herself from her daughter's perspective that she just tried to kill Mommy and telling her, you have to take care of Bree now. Mommy, I know you hate me, but I still love you. And I can't get over this. Continue with the story. Continue with this case, but I will never get over this. This is one of the most deranged things I have ever heard. Wow.
Well, like you, Detective Spinelli really felt immediately that this was not written by Ashley. And Ashley realized almost immediately that her mother had tried to kill her and set her up as the murderer. Now, detectives were so concerned that they would not allow Stacy to be alone with Ashley, as they felt that Stacy was desperate if she was willing to even kill her own daughter. So Stacy was outside the hospital smoking a cigarette when she was placed under arrest for the murder of David Castor and the attempted murder of Ashley Wallace. Now, not everyone believed that Stacy could be guilty of killing David and trying to set up Ashley. Her main supporter was her own mother, Judy Eaton. She believed that her granddaughter was the guilty party. And that was the defense strategy once Stacy went to trial beginning on January 12, 2009. Now, Stacy was indicted for second-degree murder for David's death and second-degree attempted murder for Ashley. Chuck Keller was Stacy's attorney, and his defense focused on Ashley being jealous of her little sister, Bree, when it came to their father's affections. So that was her motive for killing her father, and the way David bossed her and her sister around. That was her motive for killing David. Now, they pointed out in testimony that Ashley had written her boyfriend once when she was a teenager, that she had thoughts of killing herself when they had broken up. And they point out the fact that, well, you were asked if you ever thought about killing yourself and you said no, but here, look, you wrote this letter to your boyfriend when you were a lovesick teenager that you had thoughts of killing yourself. But that really seemed to be all they had.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm not saying we've all done that, but we all do stupid things when we're young and in love and we're trying to get our person back.
So the prosecution, led by District Attorney Bill Fitzpatrick, focused on a lot of different things. They focused on the DNA. They focused on the fingerprint, especially on the glass. They focused on linguistic analysis. So comparing how this suicide note was written compared to probably comparing Ashley's handwriting samples and Stacy's handwriting samples and computer evidence. Their first witness on the stand was Ashley. She testified what she had witnessed the last day her father was alive. She told the jury about the first round of drinking with her mother and the second time about how her mother told her to use the straw to drink down that nasty concoction. Detectives and prosecutors, well, they felt that first time that she came over, well, that was a dry run. So when asked why she continued to drink that nasty drink, Ashley replied she trusted her mother. Prosecutors believe that once Ashley passed out, Stacy then used a teaspoon to continue to feed her a mixture of vodka and prescription drugs over a 17-hour period. So the suicide note was read on the stand by Ashley, and she denied murdering her father and her stepfather. She cried while testifying and denied writing the note or trying to end her life. Now, while Ashley was appropriately emotional, the same could not be said for her mother. Stacy Castor sat at the defense table throughout the trial stone-faced. She would not even look at Ashley when she was on the stand. 50 witnesses testified, but none more shocking than Stacy Castor herself. Stacy denied killing Michael or David. She denied trying to poison her daughter. Now, on cross-examination, District Attorney Fitzpatrick didn't hold back. The prosecutors had laid out in their case, before Stacy had testified, that not only had she used the teaspoon to feed Ashley some more vodka and prescription drug mix, but that she had used that turkey baster over a 4-day period to slip David a diet of antifreeze. So DA Fitzpatrick, he played one of the wiretap tapes for the jury. And you could hear Stacy on the phone talking to a friend while she's typing away on the computer keyboard. DA Fitzpatrick also provided the jury with evidence that while talking and typing, this corresponded to the same time the suicide note was being written, and Ashley was not at home at this time. Forensic technicians also found segments of two practice letters on the home computer. Now, they didn't find the whole suicide note. Apparently, she had deleted it, but they could find fragments of that note. And the motive for David's murder was money. After his death, Stacy inherited over $300,000 plus his business and property. So at the end of the trial testimony, the jury of 10 women and 2 men went into deliberations, and it would be 4 days later, on the 5th of February 2009, that Stacy Castor would learn her fate. Stacy, ever stoic, listened as she was found guilty on one count of second-degree murder of David Castor and guilty of second-degree attempted murder of her daughter, Ashley Wallace. After the trial was over, some of the jurors shared that they didn't believe Stacy's testimony. They really focused on the timeline of events and the opportunities she had to poison both David and Ashley. She wasn't charged with Michael's poisoning, but the evidence found from his autopsy was allowed into trial to show that this wasn't her first time using ethylene glycol. So at Stacy's sentencing hearing on March 5th, 2009, Ashley read her victim impact statement. Ashley asked her mother what gave her the right to play God and ruin so many people's lives. She tells Stacy that she never knew what hate was, but that now she did. She tells her mother that even though she did hate her, she loved her at the same time. And it bothers her and it confuses her as to why her best friend took that all away. She tells her mother that she didn't get a chance to say goodbye to her before and that this would be the last time. And as horrible as it makes her feel, goodbye, Mom, were the last words she spoke to her. Stacey Castor was sentenced to 51 years in prison and she would never see or talk to her daughters ever again. Stacey, or the Black Widow as she became known, died of a heart attack 7 years later in the Bedford Hills Maximum Security Prison for Women in Westchester County. She was 48 years old at the time, the same age as David Castor. During the investigation into David's death, I told you we'd come back to the will, detectives uncovered evidence that David's will had been forged. In 2009, David Jr. sued to reclaim his father's estate. He sued Stacey Castor along with Lynn and Paul Pulaski. Now, there were two other people he also sued, but I think they settled out of court. Because the Pulaskis, remember, were the ones that witnessed David signing the will and then verified their witness signature in the surrogates court. And it turns out the Pulaskis had signed the will a month after David Castor had died, and then backdated it to appear that it was in August 2003. State Supreme Court Justice Anthony Paris didn't hold back his feelings when it came to Lynn and Paul Pulaski. He told the defendants that they were not innocent pawns, and they knew what they were doing, and they had bore false witness for both the will and then signing of the surrogate court statement, and they did so without hesitancy or reservation. He went on to say that they only came clean after investigators had come knocking. The Pulaskis were given immunity for Stacey's criminal trial so that they could give pertinent testimony, but not when it came to the civil case. Judge Paris awarded David Jr. the money he would have been entitled to, in addition to $250,000 in punitive damages in December 2011. In total, the judgment was $377,118.65 to be paid by Stacey Castor and the Pulaskis. However, in 2014, the New York State Appeals Court overturned Judge Paris's decision. They ruled that the public administrator of the estate and not David Jr. needed to be the one to bring court action, as David Jr. had no legal right to try to recover any money or property. The law in New York State, at least at the time, and I don't know if it's changed, did not allow someone to be compensated for losing out due to a fraudulent will. The court gave 6 months for the appropriate party to bring action against David Castor's estate, but I was unable to find if the public administrator had done so.
That's so unfortunate how that panned out. I assume the Pulaskis, that Stacey was paying them to help her.
I'm not sure why they did it. I didn't uncover. I'm assuming that maybe they got something from it. I'm not sure why you would sign a will after, you know, attest to signing someone's will a month after they died if you weren't going to get something from it. In 2010, District Attorney Bill Fitzpatrick confirmed that his office was investigating the death of Stacey's father, Jerry Daniels, who died on February 27, 2002. This concern was brought to Fitzpatrick's office by relatives of Michael Wallace. Now, Daniels had been hospitalized for a lung ailment, but was due to be released due to continued improvement. However, the day after Stacey visited him, bringing her an open can of soda for her father to drink, he suddenly died. Now, Jerry Daniels' remains were cremated. And interestingly enough, Stacey Castor was executor of his estate. He was buried in a plot next to both of her dead husbands.
Stop it. That can't be true.
Family members refer to it as Stacey's Monument of Death or Shrine of Evil. That was until 2016, when the New York State Supreme Court ruled that David Jr. could move his father's remains to a different cemetery and destroy his original headstone.
Wow. And Jerry was the husband of Judith, the Stacey's mother who defended her, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Wow. Interesting. And also interesting that all of these deaths happened, right? 2000 to like, it was all in a span of a few years.
Yeah.
Like she hit hard times or just.
Well, I think her marriage wasn't going well with Michael Wallace. And I'm not sure why you just wouldn't go through a divorce, but for whatever reason, Michael Wallace, you know, dies in 2000. Her father dies in 2002. Whether she was connected to that or not, there's speculation. She meets David Castor. He's very successful, has his own business, and she marries him. And then he dies in 2005. And then the police, because they're like, yeah, these are too many suspicious deaths around this woman. You know, they continue their investigation. But before they could get an arrest warrant to arrest her, And because, you know, she knew the police were closing in from her interview, from them interviewing Ashley, knowing that Michael was dug up and what the findings would be there, she attempted to blame it on Ashley.
She probably thought she was so smart, too.
Yeah. Some people did. I will say from reading the suicide note, and I do have this linked in the show notes. You can read it yourself. It is atrociously written. And I find, again, like you read it through, to me, this reads as somebody with limited education. And we know Ashley graduated high school. We know Ashley was in college. I'm like, I would think she would at least spell check, you know, and it's all one long paragraph, no periods, no capitalization, even of names.
I mean,
and names are misspelled.
Computer programs will do that for you, Stacey. Come on.
One would have thought. But if you're in a crunch, think about it. She writes in this letter, if you read it, she said, the cops came to my school today. So this letter is being written, supposedly, on September 12th, the day the cops come to her school. But she's not found unresponsive. You know, she doesn't get the fatal kind of drink until the 13th. And this note isn't found till the 14th. So it wasn't written overnight between the 13th and 14th, according to what is written here.
Right.
So she was planning this.
My heart couldn't go out to Ashley more. It goes out more to her than I think anybody's story I've ever heard. That's terrible to have your mother, the person who's supposed to love
you no
matter what. Yep.
Your best friend.
The fact that she, you know, dad gives more attention to the youngest, so I'm going to befriend her.
Ashley says, that's not really true. She goes, I never felt that my dad didn't love me. She goes, my dad was involved in my Girl Scouts. He helped get my badges. The narrative that she was jealous of Bree came from Stacy. Mm-hmm. And there is a 2020 interview that David Muir does with Stacy Castor. It's interesting to see. It's interesting. I would watch it. I link it in the show notes.
Wow. Well, if you want to learn more about today's case and this Black Widow, she's something else, head on over to our website, criminaldiscoursepodcast.com. There you will find Trisha's detailed show notes and all the resources that she used. I don't know that I want to see Stacy. I'd like to learn more about Ashley, not necessarily stalk
her. Stacy's dead, so.
I just think that's a very powerful story. That's a lot to try to overcome. Wow. We also invite you to join the discourse and let us know your thoughts on today's or any other case through our website contact page or by messaging us on social media. You can reach out anytime to tell us more about yourself or suggest a new case for us to cover. If you've enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe on whatever platform you're listening to us on. Leave us a 5-star review, tell a friend so they can join the discourse too. And then Trish, as always.
Yeah, before we go, if you see something, say something. You might have that missing piece of the puzzle it takes to solve a crime. I think in this case, I think of Michael Wallace's family, who from the beginning didn't think something was right. And hats off to Detective Spinelli and the whole Onondaga Sheriff's Office. They also did not think something was right. They didn't let this go. I believe David Castor's original death certificate would have been suicide. But it's rare. I mean, I'm not sure why you would choose to end your life that way. It's rare, but I think it's happened. And so had they let that lie, they didn't. And they kept pushing and pushing. It might have also been undetermined. I never saw anything that specifically laid out what the medical examiner said was the cause of death. I mean, it was ethylene glycol poisoning, whether he chose to do it or it was done to him. But these detectives didn't stop.
Dogged.
And to Bree. I'm going to give a hats off to Bree because she went into her sister's room. Had she gone into her sister's room 15 minutes later? Had she not pushed her mom to call the police? Had she not done that? Bree saved her sister's life.
That's true.
So before we go, we want you to remember to stay safe out there, be kind to one another, and we need to watch out for one another. So until next time, guys.
Bye.